Hello and welcome to the second episode of Insightful Ramblings, a podcast. We don't strive to find the answer to every question or claim to be experts, but if we are able to just add a bit of insight and leave knowing more than when we started, I think we can all agree that we've achieved our goal for this episode. Please tune in to each episode and explore our questions alongside us. Each session will close with a soapbox topic that gives one of our members a chance to get something off their chest. Today's first question is brought to us by Alec, and Alec, please take the mic.
Thanks, Jacob. Yeah, my question for the group today is, how much language ability is required for effective communication? I think this question could go in lots of different directions, and I hope we get to explore all of them. Maybe a kickoff for this, just to get into the data side, as we all are engineers, is some statistics on all of our native language, which is English, obviously. Some numbers to that is there are 171,000 words currently in English language, with 50,000 or more being obsolete. And it really is incredibly difficult, as you can imagine, for any language learner to ever know as many words as a native speaker, because we've picked these up, you know, passively throughout our lives. And a native speaker like ourselves in our home language, we usually have between 15 and 20,000 word families that we have at our disposal to express our thoughts and work through everyday life. So I thought that was a good start to our discussion, just to show how complex language is and how difficult it is to really define this question. But I think there's some awesome answers we're going to come to.
Well, should we perhaps first address the kind of most foundational elements of language and kind of what it, what a language is and what we see in other species, before diving into, you know, the nuances of the English language and some other, languages that some of us speak or at least are learning to speak. I know I've kind of learned a bit about some other species, mainly primates, gorillas, bonobos, that not only, communicate with one another in a group, but there's been some that I've actually learned. One's in an ape research institute in Iowa, but actually learned to communicate with trainers using a few different methods. But basically, it would have a board with different symbols meaning different things, and that way it could signal to its trainer when it was hungry, tired, and maybe showing some other emotions even, rather than just requirements for survival. What do you guys think about kind of the potential that animals not only have maybe their own language, but can understand humans' own language? Did any of you guys kind of see something similar? And what doorways does this open to the potential that, human languages are not actually human?
Thanks, Jacob. Yeah, that's an interesting point to bring up. And I think it proves something interesting, that an animal that doesn't formally speak English can still use English in a way to communicate in both directions too. It's able to use the language view cue cards or something like that. I think there's some examples like that in the past, and also can then receive input in the language too. And I think we see this all the time in our animals in our homes. Our dogs and cats and everything can actually understand cues to us. But is that really communicating? I don't know what we think about that. Or is that just responding to stimulus they've been trained to attend to?
I mean, you could argue that all language is just responding to stimulus I've been trained to attend to. Is saying hello, I respond hello back. Is that just me responding to a stimulus? Or it's a pretty automatic reaction, but it's communicating. I don't know. I would say I read that a dog will can learn something like 30 to 50 words. That counts as communicating to the dog, even if it doesn't have the vocal cords or anatomy required to communicate back in the same way.
Yeah, I think there's two parts there. First, saying about the vocal cords, a dog lacking vocal cords being maybe a reason that they can't participate in language, but then I guess, we could say the same about someone who is mute, but who speaks in sign language. I mean, I don't know, we call it, sign language. And I think it would be, pretty much universally agreed that that is a language. So I guess, yeah, maybe this is a bigger question of kind of just what are the boundaries of the concept of language. And I'm not sure the answer to that, but it's and also perhaps, as for just a response to stimuli, maybe language is just having, rather than a dog having, 30 to 50 responses, perhaps understanding a language just means that you then have, thousands or tens or hundreds of thousands of responses to stimuli that you have to filter through. So maybe it's just a matter of volume rather than actual concept.
Yeah, I found some interesting statistics on that back in the animal communication space. A couple of good examples were, I think it's the vervet monkeys, they can give alarms about specific predators on the order of 5, 10, 15 different predators have unique signals. So it's a signaling type communication that the monkeys can give to their, immediate family on warning of those animals. So I think that's getting on that, borderline of exactly that. Is that communication, or is that once again stimulus and just, not really a language per se, but just response to seeing something they've trained themselves to make a certain signal. Another interesting example was Brazilian free-tailed bats, very specific, but they live in groups of millions of bats, and coming back to their dens, the mothers are able to locate their young with an 85% precision amongst thousands and thousands of young bats in the cave. And there's indicators that it's both auditory communication, chemical signaling, and also obviously a spatial awareness where they last noted their young are all pieces that play into that. But I think that's a completely different way of picking up on communication or just remembering signals, perhaps could go either way.
I'd also argue that only an 85% chance of recognizing your baby is pretty bad.
Fair as well.
I wouldn't want to take those chances, a 15% chance that if I got up and walked away, I'd never be sure if it was my kid again.
But if you lived in a group of millions all in the same place, would you recognize your baby 85% of
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a fair point. I don't
the
know that I would.
Or if you left and it was in an egg and you came back and it had hatched and you were a bird. Could you find your baby?
That's a great question, Alec. We'll have to assign it to a later episode.
Well, we were speaking about Brazilian free-tailed bats, though, I believe, and they should only have live births, not eggs. So I think this is really a totally separate conversation.
That is true.
Pull it together, Alec. Veering back into animals, like you can teach a parrot English, and it's more than just it returning rote responses. Like they actually will develop an ability to communicate and talk back to you a little bit. I was looking, and there's an example of a parrot. I forget the names of the people involved, but the trainer got sick and was dying, and the parrot figured it out. And the last time they said goodbye, the parrot said goodbye, I love you, and then was like despondent for a while. So like, I'd say that constitutes actual language speaking more than the trained responses or reaction to stimuli that you might argue, that Alec was arguing that would apply to a dog or a cat or something. And then, depending on your definition of language, I know sign language got brought up earlier. There have been gorillas and chimpanzees that have learned sign language to a pretty good degree. I don't know, maybe we want to define a language as spoken, in which case that wouldn't count, but you know, the smarter animals definitely have the ability to communicate with humans and to learn our languages, at least somewhat.
If we were to come back into kind of the comparison, what is a language and focus in on really, spoken language, or I would think that any, human-focused communication probably, is in that kind of language focus area. I think an interesting, experience we've all had is being in an area that either we don't feel fully fluent in the language of the area, or working with people that aren't fully fluent in our language and interacting with us. An interesting snippet that I found on that is that you really need 3,000 of the most common root words in a language to effectively work in that scenario in a casual communicative scenario, whether it's whichever direction it might be. So I thought that was an interesting number. Any experiences along those lines anyone has?
Yeah, so I live in Sweden, of course. And fortunately for me, Sweden speaks English very, very well. So, but I mean, I work in a very international company right now. So we have people from over 100 countries on one site, English being the common language. And of course, with such a wide variety of people, you tend to see just an enormous gap in what can be considered comprehension of the language. Some people are really, really good at it, others not as much. But I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, it's really quite impressive, but the people will adapt to their scenarios and find a way to communicate. The language in and of itself may not be completely there in a very correct way. But I mean, when you are in a working environment and you may not understand the language as much, you find a way to communicate one way or another, and then I think common understanding just kind of develops from there.
Do you think modern technology plays a lot into a company like that being able to exist with different translation resources, et cetera, et cetera?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you think about like Google Translate, it's this massive tool for cross-language communication. I mean, it was interesting. I was talking to somebody and they had Google Translate listening and then typing out the what I was saying from English to Polish, and then she wanted to communicate back in English, so she would type in what she wanted to say in Polish and then read it back to me phonetically from Google Translate. I mean, it was really quite impressive. I mean, the modern tools are very, very diverse, and I mean, they're getting to be smarter and smarter. Of course, though, I mean, they're not 100% foolproof. I'm sure we've all seen some bad translations in tools like Google Translate. But I mean, when you talk about that, though, when you talk about tools for doing like active translation, there's also been more tools being made available for teaching language as well. So I mean, there's a lot of things out there that modern technology has made available for us as far as improving communication. And I guess that's kind of what the internet is, isn't it? It's one big network of communication. So anyway, I mean, I think that modern technology has made things a lot easier as far as learning to communicate in other languages or facilitating that communication. But I mean, some things never change. Like, if you want to learn a language, it's going to take time and practice. And there's not really a way around that. Like you were saying, 3,000 words, and then you have to actually be able to use them comfortably. That takes a lot of repetition.
And to kind of piggyback off of what Alan just said about how it takes time to learn languages, just doing my own research, the amount of time it takes to learn a language definitely depends on the language that you're trying to learn. So, for example, if you're trying to, the U.S. Department of Foreign Services, they have four categories of languages. So, in their Category 1 languages, they take roughly 24 to 30 weeks to learn, about 600 to 750 class hours to learn. So those languages are languages that you can learn in high school. So Spanish or French, a lot of those words phonetically are very similar to English words, so it's easier to pick up. But once you go into Category 4 languages, those take roughly 88 weeks to learn, about 2,200 class hours, not 22,000. And those languages would be like Japanese or Arabic. So somebody that their native language is English, it's extremely hard to pick up. But also looking, doing research from the U.S. Department of Foreign Services, they kind of went into more detail that if you worked in a foreign country and spoke that language exclusively 8 hours a day, and it was a Category 1, Category 2 level language, you could be at a basic fluency level in about 3 to 4 months. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
I think the question you bring up, or the point you bring up about basic fluency, is one that in the language world is really contested on what does fluency mean. And I think some people really focus in on the grammatical side, and other people really focus in on the communication side of what fluency means. I think I definitely would think that the better point is to be able to function in the daily conversational piece. That's what I would probably consider fluency. But I think the stuff from the State Department, Blake, is probably different because they really need to be able to be fully functional to support military efforts, State Department affairs, all that kind of stuff. So I have to imagine that's a whole different definition of fluency that they're working with as well.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I bet you're spot on with that assessment, Alec.
I think that Alec's point there about kind of making a framework for the original question of what is a baseline level of understanding. Well, perhaps that's how we should approach it, is just what level of language understanding is needed to kind of communicate in a day-to-day setting in a foreign language. And perhaps that's, if we draw that boundary, that gets rid of, someone like me who can say a few phrases in Mandarin and gets rid of the gorilla who can, point to signs on a blackboard, and kind of, takes the conversation, takes the requirements up a few notches, I suppose.
I think that's a good point. Some statistics I found on that kind of thread is, along similar to what Blake said, there's requirements or needs for function in different job categories at certain levels. So there's a system called the Common European Framework of Reference for Languages. It's quite an acronym. And it ranks kind of ABC with 1 and 2 levels for each ABC level of language ability, ranging from basic comprehension to basically equivalent to native speaking at the C2 level. Some examples there is, to get a skilled worker visa into the US, you have to have a B1 language level. So you have to have at least a low intermediate language level to apply for a skilled worker visa. And to enter lots of universities, graduate programs, you have to have at least a B2 level proficiency, which is an advanced intermediate, which I thought was an interesting fact as well. So.
As someone who speaks a foreign language at an A2 level, that's definitely a pretty high baseline, in my opinion, for to learn. Understandably, it's understandable why that's the baseline, but I guess just for our listeners who aren't as familiar, I been taking a foreign language for a big chunk of my life, and just. I have significant appreciation for getting to a B2 level. That's pretty strong understanding of a foreign language, I'd say. Well, do we have any closing thoughts or closing remarks on this topic?
I guess kind of stepping back a bit, like a little bit further out from the question, with some danger of actually getting away from the question entirely. We've talked a lot about things from varying from animal communication to human language. And I guess for me, we talked about what is the baseline. I don't know if we can say if there's a direct baseline. I think we have to talk about scales here because, when you think about human functionality versus other animals' functionality, those differ. So, if an animal has less activities to do, then does a language that's a little more primitive, is that really no longer a language, or is it just something really basic? I'm wondering if maybe the baseline doesn't scale with the level of functionality that you can achieve as an animal versus a human.
Yeah, or as a human, the task you're trying to accomplish.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like there's more complicated functions, I think, in where we are as a species. So I don't know if we can discount animal communication as not a language just because it's not as maybe complex as ours. But I think maybe in terms of functionality relative to like a chimpanzee's life, it scales similarly.
Yeah, the one differentiator between animal language and human language that I have found is syntax is the key word. And that really means the fact that word order can be used to build more complex phrases or communication purposes. So that's not something that is really understood to be present in vocal communication of animals, that we're able to then, the idea that you can make an infinitely long sentence using a English language just by using repetition of words, and you have describers to make an infinite number of sentences using action words and descriptor words, right? So, but that doesn't mean that they're not both used for communication, just can achieve different purposes, right?
Yeah. I guess, not all animals have the same biology. So I'm wondering if, there isn't a biological factor that plays into this. Maybe there's something wrong with our minds that makes syntax relevant and then not relevant to everything else, for animals where, sight isn't really, when you think about bats, like you were saying earlier, obviously, sight isn't a big part of their communication, but to other animals, sight may be a big part of their communication. I think we've seen, that sometimes in humans, like hand gestures are just a part of normal conversation. And especially then when you get into sign language, that is a huge, huge thing. So, there's always the biological factor that comes into this as well, I guess. So. Yeah, anyway, sorry, I diverted from the main topic a little bit, but I was just catching up on some thoughts I had while we were discussing.
And I would like to point out, too, and like Alan, I don't know if this is outside the scope of our conversation, but are we saying that the ultimate goal of language is to speak it fluently, or are we saying the goal is to ultimately get to, like, a writing level, since there's four levels of basic language, so that the first would be listening, then you go into speaking, then reading, and then writing. Writing being your last one that you would do during the process. So are we saying that's the ultimate goal, or was this topic just more focused on being able to fluently speak and communicate?
I think it's more about functional communication. Like being able, I mean, so reading, writing, conversation, again, those are aspects that are relevant only to, I guess, the kind of language we have as humans. So, but I mean, that's not, those are components that make up functional communication in our medium, but that's not necessarily the case for all potential types of languages that exist. Because, I mean, let's look at machines for a second. I mean, machines obviously can communicate with each other, but they don't use reading or writing. They exchange through electrons and things like that. It's not the same. So I think it's functional communication. I think that's really it. It's communication with intent to express something. But I mean, that's a really, really difficult topic.
Yeah, that's why I brought it up at the end.
Yeah, the point that Alan had earlier around really gets to kind of the ambiguous answer to the question, maybe, is that depending on the amount of information or the type of information that's trying to be conveyed, different levels of language ability or language types could be applicable. And that could range from kind of the animal signaling communication we talked about earlier, or the certain tasks and things we're able to accomplish with our, you know, fourth category ability that Blake references, that we can read and write and communicate that way, allows us to accomplish certain tasks. One example I wanted to bring up that Blake made me think of is in the traditional Native American society or culture, I guess, their languages were never written down. That was actually viewed as kind of taboo. So there's no written record of any Native American language that I know of, at least. And that has made that, in the modern day, very difficult for those languages to still survive, when all languages in our current day have a, you know, well-established writing system that's been around for a very long time. So that's an interesting example of something that, you know, developed in a vacuum almost, and is completely different, but still everyone would say, and I agree, a complete language system.
Yeah, I think the that's a kind of a great point there, Alec, and perhaps that's a fitting conclusion to this topic. Just that I think this is a, you know, a big topic that's you know, tough to address in probably 30 years, let alone 30 minutes, but I think we did our best. And you know, language can take many forms, and you know, I think we kind of hammered home on that. So I guess from there we'll move on to our second question, and that one is, what is your meal that you want to eat right before the world comes to an end? So just picture the setting. You're sitting with your loved ones, and it's known with as much, as close to certainty as possible, that there's a meteorite, there's some large object from space flying towards our blue marble, and we only have an hour or two remaining on this planet before impact, and it will wipe out everything. Everything's gone after this. This is your last chance, and you decide, you know, now would be a great time to have one final meal with my loved ones. What's going to be on your plate for this final meal? Would anyone like to take a bite out of that one? No pun intended there.
Boo.
I can...
You get no style points for that one. It was too easy.
still get to take credit for it. But moving on from that, say as a fan of food in every sense, I've given this question a significant amount of thought here. But for me, you know, I think the ideal meal when I know my life is coming to an end in a short matter of time. I think first I'll start out with a drink that has been a late addition. Actually, I'm only recently became familiar with this drink, but it's a chicha morada. It's a traditional Peruvian drink. It's a purple drink based made from corn and then other fruits and vegetables. It's slightly sweet, but it's not like an overpowering juice. It's more of it's very subtle sweetness. And really a complex flavor. And I'd have that along with a glass of room temperature water. That's just a must for all meals for me. The appetizers will be, I like cantaloupe and honeydew melon very much, and I would want those at a slightly below room temperature, but very slightly. Just enough to not be, I don't want them cold, but just a little chilled. And I think the texture is important as well. You can't have it too squishy, but it also, you know, can't be too firm. It needs to be that perfect, slightly firm texture. And I'd also have a side of pita bread with hummus and baba ganoush. But it needs to be good baba ganoush. It's a very difficult dish to master. I've had many poor baba ganoushes, but I would like baba ganoush that is well made, that has a perfectly smoky flavor for the eggplant. And the main appetizer will be my mother's eggplant parmesan. I think she does a lovely job frying the eggplant and preparing the mozzarella top dish, and that would be my main meal. And that's, I would be more than happy knowing, well, perhaps not happy, but I would be very content knowing that I was going to incinerate in a ball of flames shortly thereafter, but that would be bring a lot of joy to me to have that be my final meal.
Solid meal there, Jacob. I guess I will go next. Similar to Jacob, my first drink is also made of corn. A big corn guy. It would be our native spirit. It would be bourbon. I would like to have, I've never had it before, but it is one of the bourbon lovers' coveted unicorn bourbons that's really hard to find. It's called Pappy Van Winkle. It probably goes for $5,000 on the secondary market. But since the world's about to end, I might be able to just, you know, try to go someplace and snatch it up. So that's my cocktail of choice. And then I'm going to skip the appetizer. We're going straight to the main course. Don't want to mess around with the appetizer. So for the main course, it's going to be kind of funky, probably a nice filet mignon, big steak guy. And then after I've had a decent fill of filet mignon, I'm just going to go with a nice couple slices of pizza there. You know, don't want to fill myself up too much for dessert, but loved the comfort food. So for dessert, growing up, I've always liked milkshakes. My family, probably in high school, every night before we go to bed, make myself a chocolate peanut butter milkshake. And then what I've always wanted, and my family never made it for me on my birthday, but I've always wanted to try baked Alaska. For some reason, I've always wanted to try it, and I haven't had it. So before I die, I need some baked Alaska. So that completes my meal.
Blake, for the listeners and for myself, can you elaborate? What is baked Alaska?
So baked Alaska, that is a very good question. I believe it is some sort of, I think it's ice cream with almost a meringue texture, and then you light it on fire. And then so the meringue gets kind of caramelized on the top, but I believe the inside filling is mostly a ice cream. And there might be some cake in there, but I believe it's mostly ice cream and then a flamed meringue on the top. But it seems delicious. I know it may seem kind of awkward for, you know, the rest of the people. Like, why would you want to have something that you've never tried before. But it's on my bucket list. I need to try Baked Alaska at some point in time and go to a restaurant. They don't have Baked Alaska. I ask. They don't have it. And you know what? Maybe the joke's on me. Maybe I want Baked Alaska for my last meal. And you know what? Nobody has it, or all the ingredients are out. That's probably what would happen to me. Well, and if that was the case, I probably want some creme brulee. I'll go with that. You know, nice little custard. Again, flame the top, caramelize that sugar. Delicious.
I think I'll go next to kind of contrast against these meals we've heard so far, these extravagant, you know, order from a five-star restaurant or Baked Alaska. I think I want a nice home-cooked meal. In fact, I think the most fun meal to cook with your family is breakfast. And my favorite part of breakfast is hash browns. And I want them cooked on a big cast iron griddle, nice and crispy. And some eggs go along with them. Maybe some fried bell peppers, jalapenos maybe, all mixed together into a nice skillet. A nice cup of coffee. Doesn't even have to be that fancy. You know, I think diner coffee is the perfect complement to a nice hash brown egg skillet. But for dessert, I'm going to have more coffee, actually. I'm going to have an affogato.
Let's go.
Which, if you haven't had one, you must have it. It is a scoop of vanilla bean ice cream put directly under the espresso machine, and a shot of espresso drizzled over top of the ice cream. Let it melt for just a second. It is divine.
Sorry, Alec, to cut you off. If you haven't had one of Alec's affogatos, you are missing out on something in life. I wish I would have added it to mine. I think my meal already had enough in it, but they are delicious. Sorry, Alec, you can continue.
I'll take the praise, and that's my meal.
Well, my last meal certainly will not have coffee in it, because that's disgusting. No, with my last meal, I have one simple goal here, and that is I want melted butter put on something and then into my stomach. I don't really care much what the medium for transport here is. Lobster's a fine choice. Lobster basically exists to transport butter into your stomach. Sticking with seafood, could go clams. Clams are also a very nice butter option. Pancakes with some nice melted butter on them. Sticking with the breakfast, maybe I sneak into Alex's meal. He's making breakfast. I try to get some pancakes in there. Hang out with him. Don't touch the dessert, because coffee's no-go. And then for dessert, you know, Alec was close, though, because just some simple ice cream makes the best dessert. Vanilla ice cream, always good. Big fan of mint chocolate chip or chocolate chip cookie dough. Those are my three go-tos. Or if it's fall, pumpkin ice cream, also great. But, yeah, I'm just hunting for the butter for my last meal. Nothing fancy.
All right, I guess that just leaves me. So I would do a two-course meal. I guess it wouldn't really be courses once I say what I'm having. It'll be kind of clear what I mean by that. But I guess I'd go with something that's a little bit more representative of who we are as a species and as a planet. You know, so first part of my meal is a fruit salad. It's a fruit salad. You know. Enjoy the bounties of nature, you know. And I would have a little glass of white wine with that. I was thinking of a nice Riesling. And that would be part one. Then part two is getting something into the finer points of human food creation. So I think I'd do a charcuterie board, you know. Do some cured meats and cheeses, you know, on some crackers and a nice little glass of Gamay, and I think that'll be good, like a fruity red wine. Yeah, that'd be my meal.
All Are we talking Alan. New World Riesling or Old World Riesling there, Alan?
I was just I have there's some good German Rieslings out there. Okay. Germany makes some tremendously good Riesling, so I was thinking something over there. Yep.
Okay. And I know Oregon, you know, they're beginning to make some decent Rieslings out there, but I was curious.
You know, feel free to send me some bottles and I can review.
All right.
Alan, do you have specific fruits that you would like in your fruit salad?
Ooh, good question. So, I mean, I have a few things in my mind. I mean, I do enjoy a good honeydew. See, I've never been a big fan of watermelon, but I don't know, it just pops into my head for like something good for a fruit salad. Grapes, I could go for some dragon fruit. Dragon fruit's good. Apples. Yeah, you know, honestly, like for this type of scenario, I think the wider the variety and honesty, the better. So, but if all else fails, then like kind of a classic grocery store fruit salad would be fine too. Like, I'm going for the symbology here. You know. But yeah, that's my end of the world meal.
Well, that's excellent. All right, well, everybody, thank you for sharing your end of the world meals. Do we have any final thoughts maybe for our listeners on if they are looking to determine what their end of the world meal will be? If we have any hints or tips on, you know, as we are now experts on determining our end of the world meal, so perhaps we have some advice for our listeners as well. I would say if there was ever anything that you were afraid you might get sick from eating, now's the time to eat it, because you're going to be dead in about an hour or two anyway. You won't need to run to the bathroom, don't worry.
So you lactose intolerance, load up on the ice cream and put some coffee over it for good measure.
I know my wife, speaking of lactose intolerant, my wife has an extreme dairy allergy, and she said right before she dies, she wants to eat a whole pan of brownies. So there you go.
Excellent. Okay. Well, are there any final thoughts on this? And if not, I guess it's probably time to move on to close out the show with our soapbox of the day.
Sounds good. Bring on the soapbox.
All right. Let me, someone wants to set a timer for me to make sure I don't go too overboard here, but we'll see how the time goes. I may have a two-parter here, but we're first going to start off, given the time of year it is, as our November episode here. I want to just take a quick word and say a few things about Thanksgiving. You know, I think it's appropriate to coming off of our ideal end-of-the-world meals to now be talking about, you know, one of the bigger meals that we eat throughout the year. I know Thanksgiving perhaps recently is getting a bad rap for a number of reasons, but whether it's the putrid consumerism spilling over from Black Friday into Thursday evening. I know I have a number of family members who regularly leave the Thanksgiving dinner early to go shopping, or the other variety of shopping events that now line the week following Thanksgiving, or their, you know, criticisms of Thanksgiving and kind of its representation of colonialism or whatever you may have. There's plenty of others. And it was the day that half the family members just watch the Lions lose and then watch the Cowboys potentially win and fall asleep on the couch. And it's maybe lacking in actual family interaction. But I want to say, I think this year I'm going to have an especially large appreciation for Thanksgiving. You know, coming out of 2020, where I did not get to celebrate Thanksgiving with family, and actually myself, I had COVID during Thanksgiving last year. It'll be nice to see loved ones, spend time with them, you know, and I really hope that you know, people are less drawn in by the you know, grips of Black Friday and spend more time after a year off, you know, with family and friends, celebrating Thanksgiving this year. And you know, no matter how you celebrate, in my family we do a 5K in the morning, and then you know, kind of just chat and whatnot while watching football and eating copious amounts of food throughout the rest of the day. But I thoroughly look forward to that and to using this time when, you know, so many have work and school off all in unison to have a celebration, and perhaps it becomes a weekend long celebration in honor of this this time of year. So with that, I guess an early or by the time this gets posted, it'll probably be a happy Thanksgiving to everyone. And I hope you get to spend a lot of good time with your loved ones. So this will be a one-parter instead this week. I don't think we have time for the second one. So, all right. Well, that brings us to the end of our show. So thanks to Alec for his question today on language understanding. And I guess thanks to myself as well for my question on the end of the world meal. So everyone, until next time, keep on rambling.